Chapter 19. The snow glowed in the moonlight as the men looked to the far end of the bay and Kersevay House on its precipitous cliff. Lights shone from almost every window, unlike the majority of homes in the village, where only feeble candles guttered. The men were dressed in black, eyes shining through balaclava masks. One of them was listening intently to his mobile phone as the other three scanned the scene below. Behind them, hidden in the trees, were three tents, almost invisible in the darkness of the ancient wood. The man ended his call and walked towards his companions. "Right, let's get changed. We all know what to do."
"We wait," said the man closest to him.
"Yes, we wait." He looked at his watch.
"Only a couple of hours until midnight. We wait until everyone is relaxed, then we'll get the word to move."
"I hope your contact in the house knows what they're about," said the largest man.
"Oh, trust me, we are very well informed."
He lifted a pair of night vision binoculars to his eyes and searched along the hillside. Just over a prow, there was a glow in the sky, blotting out the night vision view in a flash of white.
"Some bastard started a fire over there."
"Don't worry, boss. One of the local yokels. You know how the jocks love New Year."
"I can think of a few jocks who won't be enjoying it much, not by the time we're done."
Bruce Shannon was uneasy for two reasons. He found the sight of his mother deep in conversation with Maxwell's burly bodyguard strange and disconcerting. When he had arrived unannounced in her suite in Kersevay House, she had smiled and looked relaxed, but he could have sworn that the guard looked flustered, almost furtive. His mother dismissed this casually.
"The security detail is here to protect us all, not just your cousin. He was briefing me on the latest developments in the search for poor Lars Bergner. His wife is beside herself, and no wonder. The search is suspended overnight because of the conditions. Poor man."
He stared at his phone, his second cause for concern. Try as he might, he had failed to raise Trenton Casely. He hoped that his little plan, as his mother would have called it, wasn't going awry. Casely had assured him that the people he was working with were serious and experienced. He'd asked to meet them, but the American had warned him that, because of the nature of their trade, these individuals remained firmly in the shadows. "If you see them, you probably won't see anything else, ever," he had said, with typical American overstatement. At least, Bruce thought, he hoped it was overstatement. He watched the smoke from his cigarette thread through the night air. The stars he remembered so well from his childhood were out now, twinkling in the clear sky. Living in London, you almost forgot they existed, he realized. He watched his daughter and her companion as they walked out of the bright doorway onto the steps.
"Are you sure this is a good idea?"
asked Mrs. Watkins.
"Don't worry, Warren. I have plenty of friends in the village, and it's New Year, for fuck's sake. Aren't you coming too?"
"Oh, I didn't think I was invited," she said.
"Go and get your frock on. It's party time. And don't worry, one of Maxie's goons is coming with us just in case anyone tries to disappear us like Lars."
"And you trust them?"
"Good point. But we can't sit cooped up here for the duration. Drives me mad. What do you think, Nadia?"
He watched his daughter as she gazed out across the landscape. Her face was blank, her eyes clear under the straight fringe of her hair.
"Yes. Yes, Daddy. I'd like you to come, Murren. I should have asked you. I didn't think."
"You think too much, darling," said Bruce, looking at his watch. "Where's that bloody car?"
Symington was out of uniform when Daly arrived in the small room she had been given in Kersevay House. She looked entirely different in her casual jeans and thick patterned jumper, younger and less authoritative. D.C. Dunn had been sent to locate Lars Bergner's wife.
"I thought we'd bring her here, ma'am," said Daly.
"So you're confident that the finger belongs to him?"
"Well, it would seem obvious. Worth a shot, anyhow. Goodness knows when we'll be able to get it analysed in Glasgow if this weather holds up."
"Let's say you're right, D.C. I. Daly.
Why put the finger in the minister's mug? Where's the ransom demand? I assume that's what this is all about.
Yes, I wondered that too. Either we have a cold, calculating perpetrator who murdered Grant and Brockie, then deposited this digit in the church to build up the tension and give us proof of their intentions, or it's a complete nut job.
Whichever it is, we're on our own. I've just been on the phone to HQ. It's blizzard conditions up there now. The main road is blocked by snow and two jackknifed lorries plus the airport is shut down. Nothing's moving.
At least the road between here and Kinloch is clear and we've managed to rustle up some support. We should count our blessings, ma'am.
Oh, please, less of them, ma'am, when it's just you and I.
Yes, of course, said Daly.
Sorry, I don't know your first name.
Carrie, she replied. My mother was a fan of horror films. Don't ask.
A knock sounded at the door, and Daly stepped across the room to open it. D.C. Dunn was standing beside a tall, flaxen-haired woman. Lars Bergner's wife was beautiful, but looked drained. She was wearing a long black dress that accentuated her height, blue eyes shining above high cheekbones.
"Please tell me that you have good news," she said.
Daly invited her into the room and pulled over a chair, onto which she slumped, obviously fearing the worst. Dunn pulled her mobile phone from the pocket of her ski jacket.
"I would like you to look at this picture," said Daly.
Ursula Bergner gasped as she looked at the image of the severed finger.
"Oh, my! Oh!" she burst into tears. "That's Lars' ring! I bought it for his 40th birthday!"
"Listen," said Daly, kneeling in front of the woman and taking her hand. "I know this is horrible, but in a way it's good news."
"How could this possibly be good?" she sobbed.
"We now know that someone has taken your husband. But why would they do this unless they wanted us to know they have him captive?"
"So you think he's been kidnapped?"
"Yes, I think that's the most likely reason for his disappearance. And if someone is kidnapped, there is always a reason, usually money. We're just waiting to hear what they want."
"Don't you think he'll end up like those other men, the journalists?"
"No, I think they've taken your husband for a reason, most likely financial gain. What happened to the other men was horrible, but it may be a warning, their perverse way of showing us that they're serious. A man in your husband's position is worth a lot to them."
"So, what now? What can we do?"
"We wait," said Daly, realizing he wasn't being much comfort to the distraught woman.
At his own request, Daly was taken to see Maxwell, who was standing on the terrace in the snow wearing a large overcoat. He held a large glass of whisky in his hand and was staring out across the moonlit bay.
"D.C.I. Daly at last! Superintendent Symington tells me that you're in charge of this fiasco you call an investigation. I have a number of points I wish to raise with you, so be a good man and stand there and listen until I'm finished."
Daly moved closer to Maxwell until they were almost toe-to-toe and stared down at the slightly shorter man.
"What the bloody hell do you think you're doing?"
Silently, Daly reached into his pocket for his phone.
"Read this," he said, handing the mobile to Maxwell.
Reluctantly, Maxwell peered at the illuminated screen, scrolling down with his thumb.
"Where did you get this information?"
"That's none of your business, Mr. Shannon," replied Daly, staring unblinkingly at the interim Shannon International boss. "I have two murdered men, the unidentified remains of a child, and a missing chief executive to think about. What you want is of absolutely no interest to me. I hope I make myself clear." "You realize that I'll go straight to that pretty little superintendent of yours, and beyond if I have to."
"I don't give a fuck what you do, Mr. Shannon. Now tell me why Colin Grant had almost £500,000 in his bank account from your company."
"I'm chairman of a multinational global enterprise. It may surprise you to know that I don't sign every check my company issues. I will make inquiries, of course, but I see that these payments were made by our Swiss division, who, like the rest of the civilized world, are on holiday until after New Year. Conversation over, I think."
"So you have nothing to say about this, no knowledge whatsoever?"
No. You must realize, Chief Inspector, 500,000 might sound like a lot of money to you, but it doesn't to me. I'm sure that there is an absolutely reasonable explanation as to why this payment was made. Now, I think it's time for you to answer some of my questions.
Daly said nothing as he grabbed the mobile phone out of Maxwell's hand. Take a look at this.
Must we play this little game all night?
Maxwell smirked. How tiresome. With an exasperated sigh, he took the phone again and stared at the screen.
What in hell's name?
He took a gulp of his whiskey and rubbed his mouth on his sleeve, a look of disgust on his face.
What do you mean by showing me that? I'm interested only in what's happening here and now, got it?
That picture was taken this morning. You might even know the victim.
What do you mean? How could I know this monstrosity?
It's the mutilated body of Colin Grant, the same man your company paid almost 500,000 quid to over the last few months. Does that ring any bells now? Daly could tell by Maxwell's look of horror that he knew exactly who the dead man was and why he'd been paid so well.
If you want to talk, my good man, I'm easy to find, said Daly,
walking from the terrace and back into the warmth of Cursivay House. Moore had managed to calm his wife down after the ordeal with a severed finger, and they'd arranged to walk over to the Black Quarry Inn to take in the new year with the rest of the village. As he waited for her to get ready, he swilled the brandy around his balloon glass and felt his own mood change for the better. The log fire was the only light in the room because of the power cut, but somehow it augmented the fug the spirit was producing in his head. He was relaxed and content. The chime of the old clock demanded his attention. It was 11, only an hour to go. He placed his glass on the coffee table, grabbed the big torch, got up, stretched, and stifled a yawn. Couple of beers and some good company and I'll be right, he thought, as he walked out of the warm lounge and bounded up the stairs. He knocked on the bathroom door.
Come on, love. If we don't get a move on, we'll miss the bells.
Silence. He knocked again and called her name. Still nothing. He tried the handle, and, to his surprise, the door opened. Normally, his wife, tired of him running into pee as she had a relaxing soak, locked the bathroom door. The old oil lantern was burning on the windowsill, but the room was empty, no water in the bath, and no steam on the mirrors.
Bagger, he said,
walking across the landing to their bedroom, expecting to see her asleep on the bed. But there was no sign of her. He looked in the spare bedroom and the box room. Nothing. As he ran down the stairs, he called her name again, then checked the kitchen and the downstairs toilet.
Listen, love, if you're trying to scare me, you're doing a good job. You've had your little game, now come out.
He stood stock still in the dark hall, the only sound, the ticking of the old clock.
Veronica!
He shouted as he opened the back door. The moon was bright, and he could see that she wasn't in the man's garden. He pulled his mobile phone from his pocket and dialed her number. When she didn't answer, he dialed another.
It's me. I've got a problem. It's Veronica. She's gone.
The flames of the huge bonfire leapt and sparked as the ring of eight people, holding hands, circled anti-clockwise, widdershins, around it. The deep hoods of their robes covered their faces as they chanted. With the heat of the fire and the tread of their feet, the snow had melted into a slushy circle, and each step splashed mud onto the hems of their long cloaks. Their movements slowed in time with the chant, until they came to a stop, heads bowed, hands still linked. A man's voice sounded above the crackle of the flames. Spirit of the fire, might of the sea, majesty of the sky, we are here joined as one with the one. Under this night sky, beside the cleansing flames of this fire, we bring you our tribute. They dropped their hands, and two figures left the circle. The others began a low, resonating hum. The voice called out again.
Our stone we are removed from you, but we still make our tribute. This fire is our beacon, our light, as we seek your strength.
The two hooded figures returned, this time dragging a man, his head lolling as he was half-carried, half-dragged through the mud and snow. Something was placed under his nose, and he coughed and spluttered, slowly regaining consciousness. He raised his head and called out in a foreign tongue. The hooded figures either side held him tight as his sobs broke in the night air. As the low humming gained intensity, another figure broke the circle. Standing between the stricken man and the fire, she let her crimson cloak fall to the ground, to reveal her naked flesh, orange in the flames. Light and shadow danced across her body as she walked towards the man, her arms held out straight before her. In her hands, she clutched a polished, sleek blade that flashed in the light.
"We are the old people, we protect and nurture our world,"
she shouted above the moaning hum and the sobs of the captive man.
"We are the magicians, the wise ones. We give this to the earth, the sea, the sky, and the stone."
With one fluid movement, she stepped forwards and slashed at the throat of the captive. His screams were cut short, now a strangulated gurgle.
"Now give me life and the strength to prevail."
She ran her hands down the neck and body of the dying man, as his heart pumped the last of his dark blood from the severed artery of his throat, gushing over her hands and up her arms. Chapter 20. The Black Wherry, as Jock Munro had predicted, had livened up considerably when Scott returned from the kirk. The bar was packed, and the pool table had been pushed into the corner of the room to make way for an accordionist who was rattling through his repertoire of jaunty reels and jigs. Older men and women sat at chairs and tables, keeping time, while younger revellers danced an impromptu eightsome reel to much whooping and cheering. In an effort to conserve the fuel used by the hotel's generator, most of the lights had been turned off. The room was lit by a blazing fire and oil lamps, giving proceedings a cosy, nostalgic feel. As Scott followed Jock to a table that seemed to have been reserved for the old writer, he felt more at home than he had done in the church. Though one thing was missing. He looked on as glasses of whiskey, beer, and wine were tipped back by those determined to see in the new year with insobriety.
"Something for you, or are you still on duty?" asked Jock, about to head for the crowded bar. "Ach, a wee ginger beer and lime," replied Scott, sincerely wishing that it was something much stronger. "As you wish, Sergeant Scott, as you wish."
The big man plodded to the bar, where he was soon being attended to. It was clear that Jock Munro was well-liked and respected in the village of Blan. Scott was surprised by a tap on the shoulder.
"I hope you're behaving yourself. I'll hear all about it if you're no."
"Annie, what are you doing here?"
"Och, I couldn't let you have all the fun," she said, taking a seat. "The hotel closes at 10 on Hogmanay. Thought it would make a nice wee change to come out here. I managed to bring another friend with me."
She opened her handbag to reveal a bottle of malt whisky.
"Buggered if I'm paying Jessie's prices for a good dram. You lean forwards between me and the bar, and I'll pour us a couple."
Before he knew it, Scott was nursing a good-sized dram in the small glass that Annie had produced from her handbag. He looked at the deep golden spirit as he swirled it around.
"What are you, a connoisseur or something? Neck it the new and we'll get a few in before the bells,"
she said, knocking back a large measure in one. As the whisky touched his lips, Scott could feel his senses enliven. The alcohol made his tongue tingle and warmed his throat and chest as it slipped down. Almost instantly, the world seemed like a better, happier, kinder, more interesting place. The ancient mantra of the recalcitrant drinker echoed through his thoughts.
"Ach, one or two won't do any harm."
It drowned out the tiny voice screaming no. "I'm sorry, I have to stay with this," said Daly into his mobile phone. Liz had called, wondering why he wasn't at home to bring in the new year.
"It's the last time this will happen, darling."
"Is she there?"
The question was brief but accusatory.
"Do we have to do this every time? I'm at work, Liz.
Is she?
Yes, we're working. It's all very difficult here, and I've got to keep on top of it.
Huh. I don't have to think for long to imagine what else you'll be on top of.
Liz, please stop this. I only have a few more weeks of this, and then we can do anything you want. Liz.
The line was dead. Daly sighed as he walked along the corridor, adorned with old black-and-white photographs. He looked distractedly at them as he pondered yet again on the state of his marriage. He had completely forgotten about the time, the fact it was Hogmanay even. This house, the Shannons, the tiny skeleton, the dead journalists, and the missing man crowded in. For the first time since coming to the area, its isolation bore down on him. The snow had all but cut them off. He was used to Liz being difficult. She had been that way for the greater part of their marriage. He tolerated it, hardly even thought about it, he reasoned. This time, because of the pressure of the investigation, because of the snow, maybe even because this was his last case, he was angry about her slamming down the phone, furious, in fact. He felt his face growing hot as he picked the phone back out of his pocket.
"Don't bother apologising," she said on answer. "I'm not interested."
"I wasn't apologising. I was just wondering why you are such a self-centred, rude woman, and how I've managed to put up with you all this time. I've bent over backwards to keep you happy, tolerated your fucking affairs and flirting with just about any man with a pulse. I'm fucking sick of it."
"Affairs? Well, that's rich coming from you, off spending New Year with that tart. Don't you know she's only fucking you to get a promotion? Why on earth would she find you attractive otherwise?"
"Listen to me." He lowered his voice as a policeman approached him down the long corridor. "I do not have time for this right now. Just don't put the fucking phone down on me again."
He ended the call. The cop nodded and smiled as he passed. Daly stopped at an old image. Two figures standing in front of some scaffolding. The photograph was brown, discoloured with age. It reminded him of the picture he'd seen at McGuinness's home earlier that evening, even though the people in the image were different. A well-dressed man in a bowler hat stood beside a young woman. He had a watch chain spread across his waistcoat, and his bowler hat was at a jaunty angle. He oozed self-confidence and assuredness. Daly squinted at the tiny writing under the image. "Mr. and Mrs. Archibald Shannon at the laying of the foundation stone of Kersevay House." Daly stared at the man again, and realised that it could have been Maxwell. The resemblance between the two was extraordinary. For some reason he couldn't fathom, the face of the young policeman he had just seen crossed his mind. The cop needed a shave. When Daly had been a constable in uniform, an outraged shift sergeant would have chased him the length of Stewart Street Police Office if he'd turned up for duty like that. He turned around, but there was no sign of the constable in the long corridor. One of the support unit guys, he thought. Things are slipping. He made a mental note to bring the subject up with the unit sergeant. It was a small point, he knew, but sometimes small things were important. He didn't know why, but suddenly his stomach lurched and he felt a tightness in his chest. He put it down to the acrimonious phone call with his wife. He looked back down the corridor and stroked his chin. Bruce craned his neck over the crowds in the black wherry, looking for a table for himself, his daughter, Mrs. Watkins, and their minder. He handed the tall, wiry security man a small wad of notes and sent him to the bar.
"Open a tab with this, will you? We'll find a seat somewhere. Get a waitress to come over when she's ready."
He spotted a table. The imposing figure of Jock Monroe was sitting beside two others. He'd known Jock since he was a child, when he'd been given the writer's books to read and thoroughly enjoyed them. They were full of daring do, and in the main set in and around Blan. His favourite, a children's novel, had been the one about the massacre at the castle. He'd made the mistake of letting his daughter read it when she was younger. Nadia had been so upset by it that she hadn't slept for days afterwards. He remembered his wife's face as she had tended to the stricken girl. Why was it that the ghosts of one's past refused to lie down and die?
He made his way over to Jock's table, suddenly recognizing the detective who'd been coordinating the search for Bergner earlier in the day. He gave him a nod of recognition.
"Mind if we take a seat, Jock?" he said,
above the din of the accordion and the excited revellers, many of whom were staring at him.
"Not long until Big Ben chimes in the new year."
"Be my guest."
The Shannon party took their seats as a waitress appeared at the table.
"Get my friends here, whatever makes them happy. In fact, buy the whole bar a drink and put it on my tab. Happy New Year."
He took a £20 note from his pocket and handed it to the smiling waitress.
"That's for you. Keep 'em coming," he said, winking at the girl.
"Cheers, Mr. Shannon,"
said the detective, holding up his glass. His face was flushed, and Bruce could see he'd already had a few. Lucky him, he thought.
"My pleasure, Sergeant," he replied.
"Och, less of the sergeant. My name's Brian. This is my mate Annie from the magnificent County Hotel in Kinloch."
Bruce shook the woman's hand, and she beamed in response. For the first time since he'd arrived in Blan, he felt relaxed. He looked at his daughter. She was gazing from beneath her fringe at a group of young people dancing a reel, as fascinated by them as though they had sprung from another planet.
"Here, Mr. Shannon," said the woman,
pushing a glass brimming full with whiskey across the table.
"This'll keep you going until the lassie gets back with yours."
"Cheers, much obliged."
It was time to forget about his troubles, if only for a while. Ignatius Moore was walking along the road on the outskirts of Blan, a large torch illuminating his path between the manse and the old kirk. The air was cold, the snow on either side of the road deep. The eerie stillness made the search for his wife an anxious one. He was about to turn onto the long gravel driveway that led towards the church, when movement to his left made him stop in his tracks.
"Hello?"
he called, but there was no reply. He stood listening for a few moments, then walked on. As he reached the church, a flicker of light through a long arched window caught his eye. He climbed the three low steps and turned the big brass handle of the kirk's oaken door, wincing as it squeaked in protest.
"Roy, is that you, mate?"
he said, hoping that his church officer had returned to the building for some reason. There was no reply. Distantly, he could hear something dripping. A steady tap, unnaturally loud as it echoed around the old building. He shone his torch along pews and aisles. A single candle flickered on the solid communion table, directly below the pulpit, its flame guttered at an angle, shying from some draught. The dripping sound grew louder, and in the beam of his torch he noticed that the vestry door was lying open. Normally, as it contained the minister's personal papers and the church silver, it was the only part of the church to be locked. Moore could have sworn he'd locked it before leaving the kirk earlier that evening.
"Roy? Mr. Simpson, are you there?"
The only response was the metronomic drip, drip, drip. The Reverend Moore edged through the door and into his vestry. Chapter 21. Everyone looked at the television behind the bar at the Black Wherry Inn. Thanks to the hotel's generator and satellite television, its customers could see images from around the country of the Hogmanay festivities. The picture switched between images of Big Ben and Princes Street in Edinburgh, which was thronged with revellers anxious to begin the party the city had become famous for. 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year. As the chimes of Big Ben rang out, celebrations began across the country. The customers in the Black Wherry embraced, kissed, and heartily shook each other's hands, all to the clink of glasses and the swirl of the accordion. As the first bars of Auld Lang Syne rang out, the good people of Blan linked arms and greeted the New Year in the traditional manner. When the singing ended, Jessie, somewhat unsteadily, climbed onto a table and addressed her customers.
"Right, everybody. Even though we're oxter-deep in the snow, yous will be pleased to hear that we've managed to salvage the bonfire and the fireworks. So get your coats on and follow me."
"What's going on?" said Scott. "We always go out the back for a bonfire," said Jock. "We've been doing it for years, long before those buggers in Edinburgh and London started to copy us. The field is where we hold the Blan Highland Games, but it's got an older history than that."
"Aye, it has that," said Annie, shrugging on her coat.
"Well, don't keep me in suspense," said Scott, warmed now by a few whiskies and thoroughly enjoying himself.
"It's called the Bloody Glebe. It's where the government soldiers executed every man from the castle, struck off their heads as the minister shouted for the blood of his own parishioners. A dreadful day indeed."
"That's a wee bit extreme, is it no?" said Scott, draining his glass.
"The Red Preacher, they called him. He's remembered and reviled here to this day. We burn his effigy on the bonfire every new year, a bit like yon Guy Fawkes, though we did it first."
"Hell mend ye if you didn't go to church in they days, eh?" observed Scott.
"The worst of it was he was a local man. He made sure that men he'd grown up with were butchered by the king's soldiers. The killing only stopped when the commanding officer himself could take no more. Still, the Red Preacher called for more death, as the blood lapped at his very ankles, so they say. He and his family bear the shame to this day."
"What was his name, Jock?"
"The Red Preacher? Thomas Shannon."
Moore shone his torch around the vestry, a long sideboard holding the parish silver, only used for special occasions like christenings and communion, stood beside a tall wardrobe where his vestments were stored, the old devotional threads covered by modern suit carriers. The contrast had always amused him. In the far corner of the room he shone the beam of his torch on a deep Belfast sink, into which a tap was dripping, the sound echoing from the vestry and amplified in the body of the kirk. He turned the tap off and, taking one last look around the room, noticed that the door to the wardrobe was slightly ajar. He felt a strange sensation in his chest as he stared at it, something between fear and excitement. Scott admired how the people of Blan had not been discouraged from celebrating New Year in their usual way, despite the deep snow and the horrors being perpetrated in their small community. Part of the field had been cleared to make way for an enormous pile of wood, on top of which he could make out a still figure, no doubt the effigy of the Red Preacher, Thomas Shannon. He wondered how Bruce Shannon felt about this, but the middle-aged businessman was all smiles, flirting with two young women swaddled in thick coats, scarves and gloves. Scott kept an eye on him, as Jessie, now assisted by her cousin Annie, and a group of thick-set farmers, placed fireworks in buckets of sand. Scott reckoned there were about 300 people in the crowded field. It was clear that a good proportion of the village's population had turned out, despite the inclement weather. He walked closer to the pile of wood which would soon be the blazing bonfire. The smell of petrol was strong. The effigy looked realistic, dressed in the black clothes of a man of the cloth, and sporting an improvised dog collar. The only thing that spoiled the effect was the bag that served as the dummy's head. It was white, and looked as though it had been filled with cloth to bulk it into the shape of a man's skull.
"You could at least have drawn a face on that poor bloke," Scott said to Jessie, now at his side.
"Never mind that. Mon you and take part in the competition. There's a bottle of whisky as first prize. I just hope Mekkie Deans doesn't win again. 5 years in a row, new."
"What's the competition?"
"Flinging the bale, of course. I'm hoping the cold this year will rob him of his grip. That's him out there."
Scott looked across the field, bright with the light of various lamps and torches held by the crowd. He was just about the biggest man Scott had ever seen, tall and broad with it. The bale in question was of straw, about a foot square, bound together with thick twine and tied to a sturdy rope. As the man held it in his big hands, it looked small and light. But Scott knew that it was just an illusion caused by the man's sheer size.
"Never let it be said that a Scot wasn't up for the challenge."
"That's the spirit," said Jessie, as Annie looked on doubtfully. "They've been tossing the bale here for years. Some say it represents a severed head, like the ends they used to fling for the walls of the castle. Prisoners' heeds."
She smiled, with what Scott thought was slightly too much relish.
"Aye, but Mickey Deans is a champion tosser. His father was the same. Great family of tossers altogether."
"I know a few families like that myself," said Scott.
"I must say I wasn't expecting you to call and wish me a happy new year, DCI Daily, but the very best to you and yours."
Local solicitor and coxswain of the Kinloch lifeboat, John Campbell's voice was slurred.
"We're all in the dark here. Any idea how long this power cut will last?"
"None, I'm afraid to say," replied Daly. He'd agonized about making the call, but reckoned that, despite the festivities, he needed to find out more about what had happened in the lead-up to the building of Cursey Bay House.
"I need to pick your brains, John."
"Wish I hadn't stowed as much hard beg on board, but I'll do my best."
"I think your firm dealt with a land sale prior to the construction of Cursey Bay House. Am I right?"
"My goodness, a blast from the past indeed. Yes, it was our firm. Well, the firm as it was then. My grandfather didn't become a partner until the 20s, but he remembered old Drysdale, who was mainly responsible for the case. He told me many a tale about him. Miserable bugger, by all accounts. Came to a tragic end, mark you."
"How so?"
"Well, his career was rather framed by the whole experience. Of course, he behaved in an exemplary manner as far as the law was concerned. Unfortunately, Nathaniel Stewart didn't think so. Held it against him for the rest of his life. Cursed the poor old bugger, as I recall."
"I'm pleased you know so much about this," said Daly.
"Oh, yes, one of the great old tales of the firm. We're a small-town solicitors, Mr. Daly. Our association with the Shannons has been one of the high points in our history."
Daly heard whispering, the chink of a bottle on glass, and the glug of the pouring spirit.
"Just about everything has been passed down, apart from their business, I'm sad to say."
"So you no longer do work for the family?"
"No, unfortunately not. The Shannons have always been difficult to deal with. After the death of old Torquil, Archibald Shannon withdrew his favour. He was a rum old cove, by all accounts."
"Meaning?"
"Oh, the list is endless. Suffice to say, he didn't found the empire on goodness of heart or charity. I must admit, I have sympathy with Nathaniel Stewart. I don't think the firm behaved very well throughout the Cursey Bay House debacle, if you want me to be absolutely frank."
"So you think there was some kind of injustice?"
"Well, not strictly speaking. Not as far as the written account would have you believe."
"And the unwritten account?"
"Well, I suppose I can give you an opinion, as it's almost 80 years since we worked for the family. It was pretty clear that Archibald Shannon entered into a verbal contract with Stewart, ensuring that he would have at least 100 years' tenancy on the ground upon which Cursey Bay House now stands. Stewart sold the property in good faith. Money was tight, and with 2 blacksmiths in Blan and a motor car on the way, things weren't set to improve. Who wanted to make the climb up to Stewart's business when Shannon's blacksmith shop was at the heart of the village? I dare say old Nathaniel thought that cutting the deal with a man he had known all his life would ensure the land stayed in his family, as it had done for centuries. He was wrong."
"Sharp practice, then."
"Off the record?"
"Of course."
"Absolutely it was. Please don't quote me, Mr. Daly. The existing Shannons are every bit as vindictive as their illustrious forebear, trust me. I certainly wouldn't want to fall foul of them."
Campbell hiccuped at the end of the sentence.
so it's fair to say that the Stuarts were justifiably pissed off.
Putting it mildly. So much so, in fact, that Nathaniel's descendants were questioned by your colleagues when young Archie Shannon went missing 50 years ago.
Do you know anything about them?
Old Nathaniel left this area sometime in the 1930s, I believe. He'd worked on farms, lived in a tied cottage somewhere. He decided to move away. Couldn't bear looking up at Kersevay House, so they say. As to what happened to the family thereafter, I'm not sure. I could try and find out.
Yes, if you could. Thank you, John. This is most informative. What happened to Mr. Drysdale? You said he had a tragic end.
Oh, indeed. He was found dead. His throat was cut.
In Kinloch?
No, not far from where you are now, in fact. Nobody was ever brought to book, of course. His body was found at the Rat Stone in Blan.
Chapter 22. Reverend Moore closed the door of the vestry and pulled the handle to make sure the lock had clicked into place. He shivered as he shone his torch around the empty church. Then something he hadn't noticed before caught his eye. Underneath the pulpit, on the altar, sat the large silver goblet usually reserved for communion. He definitely hadn't seen it before entering the vestry. A shiver shot down the length of his spine. Edging towards the table, he almost jumped out of his skin as the phone in his pocket bleeped.
"You almost gave me a heart attack," he said as he answered the call. "I still don't know where she is. I'm worried. You'll have to give me more time. I have to find her."
Before he could finish the sentence, movement from above distracted him. Quickly he directed the torch beam at the source of the sound. There, above him in the pulpit, a figure dressed in white, face covered in a shroud, stood, arms outstretched, head raised to the heavens. The old kirk at Blan resounded to the echoing screams of Ignatius Moore, minister of the church. Scott swung the bale backwards and forwards on the rope like a pendulum, trying to gain momentum.
"We've no got all night,"
shouted someone from the crowd, just as Scott let go. He watched it arc through the moonlit sky, well under the bar he had to get over to qualify for the next round.
"Bugger,"
he swore to himself, rubbing his freezing hands together.
"Aye, good try, Brian," shouted Annie. "You've got another 2 shots, mind, so don't gee up."
"Would this no be better done in the summer? I can't feel my bloody hands."
Next came the huge farmer, Mekki Deans. He grabbed the rope and swung it much more energetically than Scott had managed. Despite the cold, he'd taken off his coat and thick jumper. The detective could see the muscles bulging under his T-shirt.
"I hope there's no low-flying aircraft about," said Scott. "This big bugger's bound to wallop one by the looks of it."
Eventually, Deans let go, and the bale soared high over the bar, clearing it with plenty of room to spare.
"What happens now?"
Scott asked Jesse.
"Well, new we raise the bar. You've got 2 lives left, so it would be good if you could get it over this time. It'll get higher yet, if I know Mekki Deans."
"Lightly. What's the prize, by the way?"
"Oh, a bottle of malt whisky, and the honour of lighting the bonfire."
"A great honour indeed,"
said Jock, handing Scott a hip flask.
"You'll go down in the annals of the village."
He smiled wryly.
"And forby," said Jesse. "Only one policeman has ever had the honour, and that was back in 1956. Maurice McGinn, now he was a real good tosser. The Deans were fair scunnered."
"Plenty of big tossers to choose from now in the polis. But me representing the force, now there's a first. Don't go telling the bosses. I'm quite sure they'd have put somebody else up as the poster boy. Just about anybody bar me, I shouldn't have wondered," he said,
stamping his feet in the snow, getting ready for his next turn.
"If anybody can gie a good tossin', you're the man," shouted Annie. "Heartfelt, cousin, heartfelt," said Jesse with a smile.
Daly stood on the terrace of Kersevay House. The view below was stark but magnificent. To his left he could see the village. The field behind the Black Wherry was dotted with lights from torches and lanterns. Distant shouting and laughter echoed up through the night air. The great French windows behind him swung open, and the chatter and music from the ballroom inside drowned out the noises of the revellers in the village below.
"I thought you would manage one, just to bring in the new year, sir," said D.C. Dunn, as she handed Daly a crystal glass containing a small measure of whisky. "What a brilliant view! I'm always amazed that Ireland is so close."
As Daly looked ahead, the great loom of the Emerald Isle across the short stretch of the North Channel seemed almost close enough to touch. A shaft of moonlight shone along the still water like a silver pathway.
"Yes, the place looks magic, with the snow and everything."
He took the glass from her and smiled.
"Happy New Year, Mary," he said, as they chinked their glasses together.
Mary was wearing a thick coat and a bobble hat, the fringe of her auburn hair sticking out below it. She smiled.
"Happy New Year, sir. Jim."
They looked at each other for a moment, then embraced. Daly gently lifted her chin with one hand and found her lips with his. He could feel her shiver as they kissed. Before he knew it, he said, "I love you, Mary," holding her close on the terrace high above Blan. Far below, on the dark side of the mansion, a policeman gasped for breath as he wrestled with a man who had sprung out of the shadows. In a heartbeat, his body went limp. In the darkness, the attacker bent over the police officer, calmly removed the radio from his lapel, and pulled him into the darkness. Moore pulled at the large door at the back of the kirk.
"Help me!"
he shouted, realizing that it was locked. He let his torch fall to the floor as he tugged frantically at the handle with both hands. He heard the soft padding of feet behind him and turned to face it. The figure, walking slowly towards him, was cloaked in shadows.
"Please, who are you? What is happening? Take what you want, just leave me alone!"
He fell to the floor, his back against the door. The dark figure continued its slow progress up the narrow aisle. Ailsa Shannon stamped the snow from her boots and rubbed her hands together as Percy closed the back door of Cursivay House. She thanked the large minder who had accompanied her and turned to the old family retainer, who was mumbling under his breath about the clods of snow now lying in the dark passageway.
"This stuff doesn't clean itself, you know," he said, helping her off with her jacket. "Why on earth you wanted to go out on a night like this, I'll never know. And if you wanted company, you should have taken me, not that great lump."
"As you know, Percy, we have to be mindful of security. There's still no sign of poor Lars Bergner. It's awful. And I just had to get out for a while. You know how I feel. Well, when the bells ring out..."
She grabbed his hand and embraced him.
"Happy New Year, Percy."
They looked at each other, levelly, for a few heartbeats.
"Not sure how many more I'll muster. Or you come to that."
"Charming."
"At our age, the lights can go out at any time, you know. Aye, and for no reason either. Just going about your drudgery one minute, then gone the next."
"Sounds as though it will be a blessed relief for you, Percy. Why worry?"
"I'm telling you, none of us know what's in front of us. Not even you, Ailsa Shannon."
He placed an emphasis on her surname that made her smile.
"Look at this. Bloody mud as well as snow. More work for me."
"Why don't you join us in the ballroom, Percy? I'm sure the party is well under way."
He turned to face her, a look of disgust on his face.
"I don't understand you. All this mayhem, and you still find time to have a party. Well, it's not my style, I tell you."
"What do you suggest? That we all sit in our rooms and lament the night away?"
"Och, I'm not interested in that foreigner, Bergner, as aloof and condescending as that idiot nephew of yours."
He grabbed her hand and looked into her eyes.
"What about wee Archie? Does nothing touch you any more?"
She sighed sadly and squeezed his hand.
"Those bones are most likely a horrid game someone is trying to play to put us off our stride. Half the world knows about that ridiculous curse. What better way to get back at our family?"
"I'm not a bloody Shannon," said Percy,
suddenly raising his voice.
But you're part of this family. Been here longer than all of us.
Not quite, he said, staring at her.
Listen, Percy, she said, grasping his hand in hers. Stop worrying about all of this, about Archie, anything that's happened. There's nothing for you to be upset about. Please, trust me.
And what about the rat stone? He replied,
a dark shadow crossing his face.
As Ignatius Moore lay huddled at the door of the old kirk, his head buried in his hands, eyes closed tight against the horror, he was suddenly aware that all was silent. The slow pacing of the footsteps coming towards him had stopped. He felt his chest rise and fall with his heavy breath, felt the constriction in his throat, his heart beating in his ears. Every fibre of his body was tingling, on edge, waiting for the cold slice of steel or the hammer blow that would take away his life. He whispered a silent prayer to himself over and over again. Then he heard it, quietly at first, then gaining intensity as it echoed around the kirk. Someone was sobbing. He tried to steady his own nerves. The wailing seemed to come from everywhere, all around him, a piercing lament. Then came a tiny voice.
Help me, please, help me, please make them go away.
He recognized it instantly. Slowly uncoiling from the huddle he had made of himself at the old oak door, he looked through the shadows of the church. A shaft of moonlight illuminated the woman lying prone in the middle of the aisle.
Iggy, please, help me.
Through the sobs, Veronica's voice was unmistakable. Bruce watched as the detective failed in his second attempt to heave the bale over the bar. He was feeling mellow now, glad to be away from his family, glad to be having a drink, glad that he wasn't standing in the ballroom at Cursivay House, desperately trying to make polite conversation and console Lars Bergner's wife. Even though he hated the man, he felt sympathy for her and their children. To him, it just confirmed what he'd always thought about the old house. It was cursed, the last place in the world he wanted to be. He took the phone from his pocket and dialed Trenton Casely. Again, the call went straight to voicemail, and instead of leaving yet another message, he clicked the call off. He looked at his watch. Things should be happening by now. Through a haze of alcohol, he fretted as to why he couldn't get in contact with the young American. Though he'd done his bit and, as arranged, had made sure he wasn't at Cursivay House. He tried to picture his cousin's face when what was about to happen became clear. That self-satisfied, arrogant shit deserved all that was in store. Bruce revelled in the thought of him removing his belongings in boxes from the Shannon International office in the Shard, the way redundant bankers had been forced to do when the global financial crisis hit. He took another swig of his hip flask in silent celebration. Despite himself, he also imagined his mother's reaction. She'd be surprised that he'd pulled off such a coup. But would she be proud? He wasn't the boy who disappeared on the beach half a century before. He could never be. He smiled at a blonde-haired woman standing nearby. He'd been at a party at her house on Hogmanay a few years before. As her husband slept off his festive overindulgence, he'd had her on the kitchen floor of the two-up, two-down council house. He'd been surprised how loud she'd been. When he asked if she thought her spouse might be awoken by her moans of pleasure, she had just smiled and showed him a small bottle of sleeping pills. She'd crushed three into his beer. Time for a repeat performance, he thought. If one thing turned him on, it was the thought of a woman who would go to any lengths in order to cheat on her other half. He was about to walk over and talk to her, when a lonely figure standing beside the pile of timber caught his eye. The young woman was stock still, staring up at the unlit pyre in the moonlight, very much on the periphery of the crowd, rather than part of it. As everyone laughed and joked, as the bale flew through the freezing air, she looked very alone. But then again,
She always did. He felt a deep pang of guilt, and instead of walking over to chat up the blonde woman, pushed his way through the villagers to be with his daughter.
"Nadia, where's Mrs. Watkins?"
She didn't reply.
"Nadia, did you hear me?"
He hugged her close, and followed her eyeline to the top of the unlit bonfire, where the bland guy sat, its white head slumped forwards.
"Why didn't they give him a face?"
she said, still gazing up at the effigy of her ancestor.
"Oh, come on, darling. No point staring up at that bloody thing. It's just a bundle of old rags and straw. Let's join the party. We'll find out where the hell Mrs. Watkins has got to."
Bruce looked around the snowy field to try and locate his daughter's nurse.
"He has no face, but he has a smile."
"What?" he replied distractedly. "Enough of this, come on."
He pulled at her sleeve, glancing up to give the bag of rags one last look. He wasn't sure why he hadn't noticed it before. A thin red smile seemed to be slathered across the effigy's white face. He gaped as he watched this flat smile slowly turn into a broad grin. Chapter 23 Percy searched the large cupboard in the laundry room at Cursivay House. He knew he had spare salt and grit to spread on the paths around the building, but for the life of him couldn't remember where he'd put it. He cursed his age and forgetfulness.
"Bloody losing it,"
he muttered to himself as he closed the cupboard door. The old outhouse was the only other option he could think of. It, as well as the cottage he and his wife had shared for all these years, was one of the few original buildings that had stood on the land before the big mansion had been built. He'd often wondered what the place would have looked like. He'd heard stories of Nathaniel Stewart, heard about the man's power, his ferocious temper, and the depth of hatred that he bore for the Shannon family after being conned out of the land that had been in his family since the dark days, when only stories told stood as a reminder of deeds done. Percy looked along the row of keys, mostly of the modern variety, until he came to the big black mortise key, tarnished with age, but so familiar. He'd been using that key for most of his life, and every time he remembered the blacksmith who had used the old outhouse to store the tools of his trade. Though the key had lost its lustre, there was still a patch of shiny brass on the fob, worn to a gleam by time spent on the belt of Nathaniel Stewart, or so Percy imagined. He opened the large back door and stepped carefully out into the snow. The beam from his old torch was weak, casting a golden beam along the glistening white pathway. He cursed himself again for not remembering to replace the batteries. The old buildings sat at angles to each other, though the courtyard they once lined was long gone. He could see candles flickering in his cottage, which was not supplied with the emergency power enjoyed by the office block and certain parts of the house. His wife was still up, probably peering at a book in the dim light. "Bloody books," he murmured, as he shivered in the cold. He rounded the large holly bush, its red berries poking through the snow like tiny rubies. On his left was the outhouse. To his right, the former stable, which was now an office block used by Maxwell and the rest of the board when in residence. He was surprised to see bright electric light spilling from behind the blinds, an extreme contrast to the gloom he had to endure in his own home.
"Wasteful bastards," he grumbled. "If we run out of diesel for the generator, the whole bloody place will be in darkness."
He crunched through the frozen snow and stood on his tiptoes to look through a chink in the blinds. Having expected the large office to be empty, he jumped back when a dark figure passed between him and the glowing computer screens inside. He collected himself, stomping to the door and banging hard with his fist.
"Mr. Shannon, just what is going on? They'll be running out of diesel in Kinloch, you know. And bugger knows when they'll get another delivery if it snows again. Mr. Shannon!"
As he heard footsteps on the other side of the door, he reversed. A blow to his back sent him tumbling to the ground. Brian Scott was just about to have another go at tossing the bale over the bar when he heard the scream. He looked across the field. White snow and shadows in the lanterns and torches. Bruce was trying to pull his daughter away from the unlit bonfire, shouting for help as he did so. People running. More screams. Scott was breathing heavily. He heard the distant whine in his ears and shook his head to try and rid himself of the sound that he had first heard in the dark room at Carcivay House, and then on the road from Kinloch to Blan.
"No, fuck me, not now," he whispered to himself,
beginning to feel strange, hot and disorientated, everything around him slipping away. The scene before him changed. The screams were louder, more visceral. There was no snow, and a grey light shone on a sickening scene. Ahead of him, steel flashed, slicing through frail skin and thudding into hard bone with a roaring agony. Red blood, muck and gore was spattered across his shoes. He tried to banish the whine as it rose to a scream, tightening his chest. Another blade swung before him, connecting with a man's shoulder. He was kneeling on the ground, his long hair matted across his face. Scott saw blood pump from the wound as the stricken man struggled to regain his feet. A tall figure emerged, hooded by a dark cloak. He stood with his head bowed, hands clasped, then kicked the injured man in the back, sending him crashing face down onto the gory soil. The hooded figure walked calmly towards the victim and slammed his foot into the dying man's back, forcing him into the sodden ground. Scott was rooted to the spot as he watched the man struggle to get his head out of the bloody mire in a desperate attempt for breath. Red bubbled for a heartbeat as he managed to wrench his head up to look at the light one last time. The man held out his hand, begging Scott to help, pleading through the blood-slathered hair that plastered his face. Scott felt as though his head was going to burst with the screeching in his ears, his chest seemingly constricted by metal bands. He watched the man's lips move, but couldn't hear what he was trying to say. He felt, but did not hear, himself scream as the hooded figure reached behind his back and with both hands swung a long sword up high. It was then that he recognized the man being butchered to death in this hellish field. Only for a second did he think of Jim Daly. Then his vision began to clear, and he was back, lying in the snow. Two men in police uniforms dragged Percy's body into the Bright office. One of them tied the old man's hands and feet and left him propped up in the corner of the room.
"Who the fuck is that?" asked a thick-set man.
"He's the old caretaker,"
shrugged one of the others, his face a spray of acne.
"Light as a feather, skin and bone, the poor bastard. Do you want me to slot him, Paddy?"
"Just leave him where he is now. I want Maxwell in here as soon as you can get him. And stop using my fucking name. We have the upper hand here, but these bastards don't mess about. When we've finished, they'll be looking for us. So keep your pig hats on when you go into the house."
Percy started to moan in the corner and was soon silenced by another blow.
"We'll have to do something more permanent with this old geezer."
"Give him a jab," replied Paddy, "and hope to fuck he doesn't die."
He reached into a stainless steel briefcase and removed a syringe.
"This'll keep the old bugger quiet. Hope he's got a strong heart. Will we go and get Shannon now?"
"Yeah. Tell him there's been a development. Meet our man. He'll pass this on so that bloody inspector doesn't get wind. I'll send him a message."
The two men made sure that the peaks of their police hats were down low over their faces as they left the Bright office and stepped back into the yard, Carcivay House looming above them.
"Brian! Brian, are you okay?"
shouted Annie as she tried to rouse the detective, who was slumped face down in the snow. He jolted back into consciousness, gasping for breath.
"Jim! Jim, what the hell?"
"Eh? What do you mean, Jim? He's back up at the house, is he no?" "Maybe you've had one too many, Brian," she said, helping him to his feet. "You've been knocking them back since before the bells."
"Quickly, please. I think somebody needs to take a look at the minister on the bonfire,"
shouted Bruce, his sobbing daughter at his side.
"What on earth do you mean?" asked Jessie. "He's just a pile of old rags stuffed into John McEachran's boiler suit."
"If that's the case, his face is bleeding," replied Bruce.
"Come on, Brian," said Annie. "You need to get yourself together and take a look at this."
Scott stood, still stunned and breathing heavily, as Annie did her best to brush the loose snow from his clothes. He was shaking from head to toe, desperately trying to compose himself. Bruce walked towards him, his daughter now being comforted by her nurse.
"You'd better get over there, Sergeant."
"Why, do you reckon it's a stolen boiler suit?" replied Scott,
doing his best to sound normal, though he felt anything but.
"No, but I don't reckon it's filled with old rags either."
Scott was trembling. That latest episode was the worst yet. It all felt so real, like being flung headlong into another world while being slowly choked and deafened by that awful whine. The stench of petrol was strong as he stared up at the effigy on top of the bonfire. With most of the villagers gathered round with their torches and lanterns, it was much easier to see that the white bag that served as a head was now stained a dark crimson colour.
"Right, I'll need to get up there and have a look," said Scott,
his voice throaty and unsteady.
"Can someone come up and give me a hand?"
"I'll help you,"
said Mickey Deans.
"Right, fine man. Come on."
The pair slowly scaled the mound of old wood and general rubbish that the bonfire was constructed of. Scott's foot slipped through a rotten plank to a gasp from the crowd, but Deans, coughing at the stench of petrol, soon pulled him free, and in no time both men were perched, somewhat precariously, at the top of the pyre. As soon as Scott touched the sleeve of the old boiler suit, he knew it wasn't filled with old rags. He took a deep breath and gently pulled up the white bag, now almost entirely stained a deep red. He recoiled in horror as a frantic murmur, then screams spread through the crowd. Scott stared at the face before him, almost unrecognizable as human, thick blood oozing from a dark wound that appeared to have been hastily stitched up with rough twine. A strand of pale hair, not soaked in gore, caught the light. Then Scott heard a deep thud, a puff of sound. There was a crackle, then a roar, and suddenly the bonfire burst into life, blue flames devouring the petrol-soaked pyre.